Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Today, Bridget Griffin shared a video of her daily yoga routine, two self-help articles, and her new blog called Build Your Inner Bridge with Bridge. Girl, your sharing has turned into oversharing. No worries, Bridge. Geico has some info worth sharing with your 7 blog followers, like how you could save money on your car insurance, update your policy, and report a claim just by visiting geico.com. How's that for building your inner bridge? Bridge, Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Chuck Moore Speaks podcast. I'm joined by Gaurav Bala. He is an author of Awakening a Leader's Soul, Learnings Through Immortal Poems. Gaurav, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, Chuck. Glad to be here.
Gaurav, before we get into the content of your book, could you give me a little background on yourself and how you arrived at a philosophy of examining leadership?
Well, you can use either two metaphors for me. You can either call me a gypsy or a Renaissance man. I have moved around a lot in my life. I grew up in India, and I have a bachelor's honors in economics and mathematics, an MBA from one of the most prestigious management institutes, the Indian Institute of Management, Ahmedabad. I worked for many years in India with Richardson Vicks, Procter & Gamble, and Nestle in marketing and strategy. I came to the US, did my PhD in marketing and strategy, and then never stayed in the university system, but continued as a consultant and as an entrepreneur. So I have seen the workplace from several different angles. I've been a national executive, I've been a business consultant, an entrepreneur, an educator, executive education specialist, author and speaker. And I've been global long before it became fashionable to talk about being global. I've worked on 3 different continents. I've interacted with executives in over 30 different countries. I am published in both business and literature. So that's how my interest in poetry, and I have a novel that's also been published. But many years ago, I was facilitating a discussion on a new product launch. And everybody was arguing. I'm sure you've been in a room where everybody is shouting at everybody else and nobody is listening. And the best part is the data was sitting right there. I mean, I had presented the data and it was a very clear verdict that the market did not want the new product. Nobody wanted the new product, but the company was desperate to, you know, consider new ways of enhancing revenue. So being the facilitator, it was not possible for me to just sit back and watch and listen because, you know, a lot of time was flowing by. So suddenly out of the blue, Robert Frost's lines came to my mind: the secret sits in the middle and knows. We dance around in circles and suppose. So I said those lines and everybody looked at me as if I was really strange and stupid. But I said them again and I said them again. And it sunk in that I was trying to communicate something. And then I said it in so many words. I said, folks, we have a choice. We can either listen to the data or we can listen to our own vested interests and perspectives. Well, I would be lying to you if I was to say that everything sorted itself the very next minute. But by the end of the day, within a few hours, there was definitely a change in the mood of the group. There was much more constructive discussion. And even the disagreements were handled much more productively. And by the end of the day, we had a very clear sort of convergence of opinions and ideas in how to move forward. So that's in a nutshell how I came to this stage.
So you were able to step back in that meeting and get people to just slow down and take a look at the actual facts before them rather than be so wrapped up in their emotions. And I've had similar experiences as a radio talk show host who's worked with many different stations and also interviewing people who are parts of startups and small companies that sometimes are maybe not going to make it or that are involved in some mistakes and they can't really get beyond that to repair it. And I think a lot of times people get wrapped up in their egos and in their emotions. And they fail to step back and take a look at the facts, you know, because we get wrapped up in something. We want it to succeed to the point where we might filter out things that may not be right. so that we can almost pretend that it's going to succeed until one day we wake up and discover that the whole thing has failed. So you talk about in your intro here, you know, thinking with your soul instead of with your head. Can you talk about that dichotomy and how those two functions are different?
Happy to, but let me just reinforce something you said, though, that on that particular day when I was facilitating that meeting, I could have thrown the rule book at them, but that wouldn't have helped. I think what's interesting is that those two lines of the poem helped them see things differently than anything that I could have thrown at them or anything that the CEO could have thrown at them. And that's precisely the difference between the mind and the soul. I mean, if you look at it right now in today's environment, this whole so-called leadership industry is big business. I mean, millions and billions of dollars are spent on leadership training. America alone spends about several billion dollars, upwards of 10, you know, depending upon whose estimate you want to consider. So if you look at that training, that's feeding your mind because it's teaching you all these concepts and ideas and frameworks and theories, etc. But in today's age, problems don't come with neat little tags which says right or wrong. In fact, if you look at the history of leaders and leadership, leaders and leadership has never come with a rule book. You are supposed to trust a certain sense of judgment and perspective. Where does that come from? Not from Harvard and Stanford cases. That comes from within. It comes from who we are, what we are all about, what we stand for, what we are willing to fight for, what we are willing to step back from. And the proposition over here is that the head may be smart, but the soul is wise. So any leadership training that neglects the soul is actually churning out incomplete leaders, which is why we have such a leadership crisis today, which is why so many people feel that the workplace is dehumanized and where they feel disengaged with their work and their organization.
Okay, we're joined by Gaurav Bala, and we're talking about soulful leadership and where perhaps our style of leadership, maybe in the West, is a bit too focused on data and statistics and facts, and sometimes we miss the bigger picture. When you talk about the soul, I mean, are you talking about someone's character, the sum total of their experience? You know, what do you mean by wisdom?
Well, I don't quite use the word wisdom. I mean, wisdom is a byproduct. I mean, it's something that we sort of infer based on someone's actions. And I define soulful leadership, and by the way, Chuck, I do not want to sound jingoistic or chauvinistic. Soulful leadership is not just a preserve of the East. I mean, you can find tons of examples of soulful leadership even in the West. And the way I define soulful leadership is very simple. At any time, any leader, when they are faced with a decision, they have three entities that they are working with. They are working with their own desires and needs and preferences and wants. They are working with their principal stakeholders. There are other people that are involved, and they are working with resources. All leadership roles, and by the way, I conceptualize leadership as a role. I conceptualize leaders as ordinary people playing a role for a finite amount of time. And I conceptualize leadership as a journey that leaders have to embark on during the time that they are at stage. It's very much like what Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage and we are but mere players, and we have our entrances and we have our exits. So President Barack Obama had his entrance in 2008, it's 2016, and he has to exit because his two terms are over. During this time, he led America on a leadership journey. And soulful leadership says that every decision requires a sacrifice. You have to sacrifice something. You have to sacrifice something of yourself. You have to sacrifice something of other people. And you have to sacrifice resources. How you balance the sacrifice, how you blend in terms of where you lean, what you sacrifice more, what you sacrifice less, determines soulful leadership. So if all the time the trade-offs are determined solely based on our own vanity and our own wallet, then that is not soulful leadership. So soulful leadership is not a 1-0 situation. It's a question of degree, but it's a question of an inner awakening, a leader who's highly self-aware, who's very conscious of what is being asked of them and what is it that they have to do so that in that sacrifice, the majority benefit and not just they.
Well, you know, I suppose that sacrifice is part of any leadership decision, because when you make a decision to do course number A over course number B or C, then you're sacrificing course number B or C. You know, you're basically looking at a situation and you're adding up which course you think is going to be the most successful. And that's when leadership comes in. Your experience, your character, your insight, your luck even, all these things come to play when you have to decide which course to take. And, of course, you could be wrong. But when you do that and when you make that decision, then naturally you're sacrificing. You're sacrificing other possible avenues, wouldn't you say?
Yes, absolutely. But there is more to it. So imagine you are a CEO of a company. And and there are lots of CEOs who want to have more. I mean, their entire corporate philosophy can be summed up in one word, more, or bigger, or best, or greater, or greatest, whatever. One word,
right.
Philosophy. Now, let's say that you embark on a merger and acquisition. So the best way to answer your question, Chuck, is by asking you a question. I know it's not polite, but it's very effective. Who benefits from mergers and acquisitions? So if,
it depends on the situation. I mean,
exactly my point. Exactly my point.
You know, sometimes
a merger
so that's where you get into that, you know, are you sacrificing some aspect of something in order to get to something bigger? And, a merger or an acquisition can mean that the company being acquired might be saved. I mean, otherwise they could completely go out of business.
To the contrary, very often companies that are acquired, hundreds and thousands of people lose their jobs. So this is what I'm bringing into focus is that soulful leadership is a very conscious exercise of trade-offs and decisions, because there is a sacrifice involved. And there are tons of leaders that never sacrifice themselves. You may remember that when we have the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, you remember that oil spill?
Sure.
Okay. You may remember that the CEO of the company, British Petroleum, at that time said, I wish this whole thing could be over so I could get on with my life. What was his life all about? There was a yacht race that was taking place in which his yacht was sailing. He really didn't want to be around. Okay. It was like an accident, so it was not his fault. Okay, and the fact that he said, it's not that great a spill. I mean, it's a very big gulf, and this is a very small spill. But it was one of the biggest spills in the history of oil spills. So that is a very interesting example of how the person was willing to sacrifice everything else but themselves. And soulful leadership is not that. Soulful leadership is a balancing of all that needs to be sacrificed. And it's a very clear reckoning of who stands to gain and who stands to lose.
Well, I mean, I suppose that by saying that he wished the whole thing was over, that doesn't necessarily mean that he wasn't going to do anything about it. He just wished he could get it done quickly, get the thing capped. But, of course, a company is going to try to cut corners, or they're going to try to engage in unethical behavior because it profits them, and that's hopefully what the free market's about. I know that when in the course of my radio interviews, I've done some programs on certain players in the pharmaceutical industry who deliberately keep people hooked on certain drugs because it benefits them. They view customers, they view people who are, you know, that they're just clients that make them money. I mean, I think that you could point to that, especially in the medical field and in the psychiatric field too. No, of course not. I'm saying that it's despicable. I mean, that they're actually using people's sicknesses to, further their pockets. I think that has a lot to do with the opioid epidemic. You know, everyone hooked on drugs they make money from each of these people. They could probably get them off the drugs very quickly, but then they would lose their customers. No, I think it's disgusting and wrong. You know, I guess that the question is, I think that the solution to that, though, is not to ask people somehow to magically become ethical. That's not going to happen.
No.
The solution is to have a free market where and a free association of ideas where they can be identified and where public pressure could be brought to bear and maybe even legal pressure. I mean, that's why the BP oil was eventually capped. Not because that CEO is such a great guy. I don't expect that. But I expect pressure being brought to bear by the public who's concerned about the environment that is going to make him do it. And if he doesn't do it, the consequences are going to be far greater than if he does nothing and pretends it's not there.
Well, my book approaches it slightly differently. It doesn't rely on market mechanisms or legislation or external pressure. And that's why the link to immortal poems, because immortal poems are like mirrors. They force leaders to confront their own humanity or lack of it. So the thesis of my book is that soulful leadership is something that comes from within, that starts from within. And the more you're aware of the kinds of issues that are involved in taking an organization on a leadership journey, the more you can keep your ego in check, the more you can be yourself rather than trying to pretend to be somebody else, the more you can take intelligent risks as opposed to reckless risks, the more you can doubt the your own decision that you can be right and you can be wrong, then you can start sowing the seeds of soulful leadership. So the thesis of the book is it comes from within. Immortal poems help us look at ourselves in a different way so that we can behave in different ways and we can achieve different kinds of results.
Good. I mean, look, I think, by the way, my guest was Gaurav Bala, and you can check out his book on Amazon.com. Gaurav, I think that most people who are in business are ethical, and they do have humanity, and they do have a bigger picture. But there's always bad players. I mean, that's just part of human nature. And I think that, as Lord Acton famously said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. In which when you have people who get into a habit of corruption because of their power and collusion with others who are also gaining, then they start to lose touch with their humanity. I mean, I point to the pharmaceutical industry. I don't mean to single them out. We could take a look at some other areas, both governments and private, that there becomes a culture of corruption. They lose touch with the fact that, somebody actually got them where they are. Maybe they did it, maybe they inherited it, and that they become entitled. They feel that they can do things, and it's almost a sense that they have some greater enlightenment, that they can make decisions for everyone else. And I don't expect these people to suddenly get a fit of humanity. I expect them to be brought to bear by consequences of their action and from a public that is aware of its own power and that can expose them. You know, and can shine the light on them and basically bring up, go to war against them, I suppose.
Well, Chuck, the first of all, I just want to clarify one thing, that the book will be out later this year. So it's not yet on Amazon, but it will be on Amazon later this year in Q4, hopefully. We are still in the business of finishing and publishing it. So, later this year. But
sure.
I think the issue that you are raising is what I would call these decisions are characterized by right and wrong. My whole book is not about decisions that are a choice between right and wrong. My whole book is a very interesting dilemma, a conundrum that leaders are often confronted with when they have to choose between right and right. So, for example, let's say that you are the head of a department in a company, and there is only one person that you can promote. Who would you like to promote? Would you like to promote the person who has spent 20 years with the company? In short, would you like to reward loyalty and commitment? Or would you like to promote a person who has only been there 5 years, but who is a very sharp whippersnapper, and who you know that can take the company in directions in the future that the person who spent 20 years cannot take? Now, that's not a decision of right and wrong. That's a decision between right and right. Both sides have their merit. Both sides have their demerit. Who do you pick? And that's where soulful leadership comes into play. And it's a question of degrees, because there is no such person in this world who is perfect. And there is no person in this world who is imperfect. I come from a part of the world where our culture and our scriptures say that no human being is all good, no human being is all bad. So soulful leadership is a question of degrees. And every single decision that we take, including when you go out and buy fast food, the container that you are served in, you know, the styrofoam, a bottled water, plastics, you know, contaminating the oceans, whether somebody has a 30-minute shower or somebody has a 10-minute shower. These are all not right or wrong. This is right versus right. And that's where soulful leadership comes into play.
Well, I mean, of course, you know, that's very interesting. I mean, you know, you have to weigh and measure the consequences of decisions. You know, I mean, if you promote the guy that's only been there for a while, that could hurt the morale of the whole company. It could hurt a friend. I mean, you could hurt, and that can have negative repercussions for the whole company. You know, you could make enemies. At the same time, I suppose the wise leader is going to find some kind of a compromise, maybe where they can somehow figure out a way to include both people so they can take advantage of both of the plus aspects and the talents of both. But yet maybe that's where sacrifice comes in, and that each party is going to have to give up a little something in order to get something else. You know, it's kind of like taking half a loaf rather than no loaf. But I suppose those are all questions. Yeah.
You're that's how Chuck Morse would exercise his soulful leadership. Somebody else might decide to do it differently. You know, they might decide to give the 20-year-old person a hefty raise, but they may give the promotion to the young whippersnapper because they believe that if they don't take care of the future of the company, more jobs could be at stake, and that giving the promotion to the 20-year-old person could actually jeopardize the long-term health of the company. So different people could arrive at the decision differently, but
right.
I mean, the very fact that you are giving it some thought, the very fact that you're weighing those decisions, the very fact that you're treating both people as human beings and not as objects, etc., that right there is the exercise of soulful leadership.
Well, man, I think that everybody in that sense has some soulful leadership in that it's based not just on a looking an examination of the people involved, but it's also an examination of self-interest, because if, in fact, it comes down to having to make a decision where you can't include both and you're going to either go to number A or number B, then you have to weigh and measure the consequences, you know, which is going to be worse. Because there is going to be damage, you know. I mean, that's just sometimes the way life works, you know.
That's true.
As President Kennedy once said, life is not fair. You know, there are, you know, you have to make sometimes the hard choice at the end of the day, and ultimately, I think it comes down to self-interest and the interest of a particular organization, and that you know that it's whether or not they can weather the pain of having to make a difficult decision.
Oh, well, I said before, there are always three interests involved. There is the leader, their own self-interest. There are all the other stakeholders, and there is the interest of the resources. The how you actually make a decision in terms of what resources you consume, what resources you sacrifice, all those are also, you know, they get involved, and they also sort of characterize soulful or soulless decision making. Now, respectfully, yes. As I said, again, I'm repeating myself, but I think it's important to repeat myself here, that soulful leadership is not a 1-0 kind of a situation. It's a question of degrees. So, for example, there's Mr. Shea, who is the CEO of Box.com. Okay, he recently was in the news because he paid, tuition fees for some of his people who wanted to study get advanced education but could not afford to pay the tuition fee right away. Netflix decided that they were going to give the father maternity leave also, and not just the mother, because, you know, both parents needed to be involved in bringing up the child. Mr. Tim Cook, who is currently the CEO of Apple, stepped into some very difficult shoes, Steve Jobs, but he never tried to imitate Steve Jobs. He never tried to be a second-hand Steve Jobs. Instead, he concentrated all his energies on being a first-hand Tim Cook. So was the case with Jeff Immelt. He stepped into very difficult shoes of Jack Welch, but he never tried to be a surrogate for Jack Welch. In fact, he was himself. And not only that, he turned around several of the policies of Jack Welch, because the Jack Welch way had had its time, it had its productivity, and was not going to help GE in the future. So if you look at GE's composition today in terms of how their business is structured, it's very different. They've sold off all their financial interests, etc. They're concentrating on manufacturing. They're concentrating on, they're moving away from globalization. And that, again, is an example of soulful leadership, that you don't try to just sort of ride the crest of success based on someone's reputation, but you take into account current realities and you adjust your navigation based on what's going to play in today's world and not what played in yesterday's world.
Well, yeah, I think that's just basically good business. I mean, I don't think Jack Welch would be Jack Welch today either. You know, I mean, anyone who leads an organization or a company or any, you know, they adapt to changing conditions. You know, and if they don't adapt to changing conditions, they're probably going to go bankrupt. I mean, I was the CEO of a company that eventually went bankrupt because I didn't see the changing conditions around me. And one day I woke up and found that everything had changed and that my company had become irrelevant.
That is correct. So you were a CEO. You've seen that happen. There are plenty of companies around the world where it happens every single day. So obviously there is a certain mindset that certain CEOs have which say that because we are successful, you know, we can continue to be successful. In fact, if you look at Jim Collins' book, How the Mighty Fall, the very first chapter in that book called Hubris, there is a certain arrogance that comes with success and which breeds soulless leadership. So it's all around us. It is not to say that it's good business. It could be very good business, but then why doesn't everybody follow it? Because it is also human nature that they pat themselves when they're successful and
I think it's also a sense of complacency. You know, you get lazy. You know, if something is successful, you kind of move on and you say, okay, I've done that, and then you just keep going and you don't necessarily keep an eye on changing conditions. And that's not just true in business, it's true in politics. You know, that's why political parties and governments can fail, because they were successful and they don't pay attention to changing conditions around them, so they don't see something coming because they're sitting on their laurels. You know, I mean, that's what happened
to me. That's why in my book, I'm not restricting my book to just organizations. I have examples from countries. I have examples from other social institutions. The Catholic Church is a tremendous example of that. In my own country, India, is a tremendous example. I mean, they were very successful, you know, for a certain while with outsourcing and software, but now they have to find new ways. And then suddenly China comes around and they are very successful with manufacturing. But, you know, that strategy is wearing thin. So naturally, now you have to find other ways of balancing, you know, your own interests and the interests of others and the interests of the world. That's where the resources come into play. And clearly, you can find sufficient examples of soulless leadership in the running of countries, in the running of states, in the running of the United Nations. I mean, you've had the Kyoto Protocol, you have had Rio, you had Rio Plus 10, Rio Plus 20, and yet where is the world today when it comes to soulful leadership in combating global warming and climate change? Very little of it.
Well, I mean, again, that's an example of where you have self-interest and quite honestly, corruption wrapped up into an issue.
And but that's precisely the point of the book.
Yeah, I mean, if the solution to that is to help let third world countries emit more carbon into the atmosphere, I mean, that doesn't solve global warming. And that's what that is, assuming it is man-made. And that's been the thesis of the UN. So, you know, you've got an agenda there. Perhaps that's an example of where ideologies and political interests can trump the truth. Anyways, Gaurav Bala, I want to thank you for joining me. I want you to let my listeners know where they can get more information about you and your work.
My website, www.gaurabhalla.com. And I'm coming up with a brand new website. The old one's still up and running. The new one should be up and running within a couple of weeks. And I'm also on LinkedIn. So the two best ways to get hold of me are through my website, which is, again, my name, gaurabhalla.com, and my LinkedIn profile, which is fully up to date and comprehensive.
Well, Gaurav, I want to thank you for joining me. Let's do it again sometime. Keep me posted when your book is out. Maybe we can revisit and talk again. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Chuck. Enjoyed the conversation.
Okay, my pleasure. Okay, so that wraps it up for today. I just want to mention before I sign off that my books are available at Amazon and Amazon.com. My latest book, Communism is Not Dead, the Communist Conspiracy in the 21st Century, is available now at Amazon.com. Thank you for listening, everybody. Have a nice day.
Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Today, Bridget Griffin shared a video of her daily yoga routine, two self-help articles, and her new blog called Build Your Inner Bridge with Bridge. Girl, your sharing has turned into oversharing. No worries, Bridge. Geico has some info worth sharing with your 7 blog followers, like how you could save money on your car insurance, update your policy, and report a claim just by visiting geico.com. How's that for building your inner bridge? Bridge. Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.